Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
We all knew it was coming soon, the end of the Football by Numbers series. We are at number 99, and we have Larry Schmidt, the guy that started it all with number one, as we talk about the end of the line, number 99. These stories of these great heroes and more in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com here, and we are at the end of a series that we've had here on PigskinDispatch.com. The Football by Numbers, this is our last episode on it, jersey number 99, and we are going to go to the person that helped start it with number one. It's our first guest on talking about the actual jersey numbers. Bill Schaefer came on, talked about the uniforms prior to that, sort of a prequel. But Larry Schmidt of Gridiron Uniform Database, Big Blue Interactive, he joined us to talk about number ones, and he wanted to be the one to come on and talk about 99s, the last number. Larry Schmidt, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Darren.
Yeah, this is a nine-month journey that you and so many others have helped we take and go on and talk about these greatest players in NFL history. And this has really been a great ride, and I appreciate your efforts and everybody else's. It's made this such a great series to have.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed listening, and I'm honored to be the bookend, to be number one and number 99. So thank you.
Yeah, all the volumes are in between. You are the bookends, that's for sure. I guess where we always start off is we sort of talk about what the Pro Football Hall of Fame has to say about number 99. And it's been kind of uncommon in the 90s. We've only had, maybe one, sometimes zero players that are in the Hall of Fame. But tonight we have four that were number 99, according to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And those are Jason Taylor, Warren Sapp, Dan Hampton, and Cortez Kennedy. And I guess maybe if we want to start with them, or if we want to start in a different direction.
Sure. Yeah, we have three solid guys who wore number 99 for their entire or the majority of their career, and then we have one asterisk, so we can save him for last.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
I remember we had this with Forrest Gregg, because he wore numbers when I did number 79. He wore 79 for his one season in Dallas, where he only played like three or four games.
Yeah.
But he wore number 99, and he had a big year wearing that number, so we'll definitely give him his due.
Yeah, and listeners, don't let it fool you that there's only four in a Pro Football Hall of Fame, because there are some players. I think we're probably going to have at least two or three that are probably in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in the next 10 years, probably.
There's two guys playing right now who definitely will be.
And there's another guy with a retired number that's not in the Hall of Fame. So we've got some good players to talk about. So this is going to be fun.
Why don't we start with Dan Hampton?
Okay.
He's our most senior Hall of Fame member. That wore number 99. He played for the Bears from 1979 through 1990. And he was an extremely, aside from being a very talented player, he played on the great 85 Bears defense. He switched back and forth between defensive tackle and defensive end a few times in his career. And he actually made the Pro Bowl he played in four Pro Bowls twice. He made it as an end, and twice he made it as a defensive tackle. And when he was all pro his one year in 1984, when he had 11 and a half sacks, he made that from the defensive tackle position. And double digit sacks as a defensive tackle in a 4-3 defense is that's very impressive. You know, typically it's your ends that get the big sack numbers. And in 1986, he had a 10 sack season. And that season he did that as an end.
Yeah, especially getting that many sacks when you have the talent that those Bears defenses had during that period.
They had Richard Dent was getting a lot of sacks from the end position, and you know, he had William Perry in the middle of the line and Mike Singletary backing them up, and that was a formidable group. But you know, Dan Hampton, he was as good as any of those guys, and you know, that's why he was elected to the Hall of Fame in 2002.
And most of those years were Buddy Ryan was their defensive coordinator. And it's not like he ran a normal defense. He had some crazy schemes, crazy formations. And that's what made the Bears be so great, is just the innovations and the talented players that they had all across that defense. And Dan Hampton was definitely centerpiece of that.
Yep. He did that with a lot of asymmetrical gaps with the line. A lot, sometimes he would come off the diamond position where he would have a nose tackle and two tackles like all lined up over the nose tackle would be head up over the center, and then the defensive tackles would be shoulder to shoulder, and they would both attack the A gap, and he would have overloads with a safety and an outside linebacker on one side. And it was just, you know, at that time it was new and it was chaotic, and offenses just didn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so yeah, definitely.
And it helps when you have good players. It's not only scheme. You know, everything looks great on the chalkboard, but you know, when you have the players to actually execute the scheme the way you imagine it, that's it's something else.
Yeah, and Hampton was a stud at Arkansas when he played there. Just brought his college career and numbers, and jumped right in the NFL and took right off very quickly, and had some great years. Four and a half sacks as a rookie. That's pretty good in the late 70s.
It is. And he unofficially in 1980, I mentioned he had 11 and a half sacks in 1984. Sacks became an official statistic in 1982. But in 1980, the Bears unofficially credit Hampton with 11 and a half sacks that year, too.
Yeah, you can't go wrong there. I'm not sure. John Turney, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
I am.
Pro Football Journal. He's
yes.
And Nick Webster are the ones that sort of did most of the study and the legwork on these statistics, looking at game film, game books, everything. And we talked to John just about a month ago, and what a labor of love that was. And that's what Pro Football Reference is showing all his numbers pre-1982 now, 1960, I think, to 82.
Yeah.
So, we thank him and Nick for those numbers, because it's definitely revealing on some of these great players like Hampton. Okay, so I think Dan Hampton, I think we'll be in agreement that we'll want to have him on our list of top 10.
Absolutely.
Okay. I was hoping so. Okay, now what player would you like to go to next?
We can go to Warren Sapp next.
Okay. Great player.
He played especially in the Tampa Bay years. He was a Buccaneer from 1995 through 2003. And it's just worth mentioning, since I am a Gridiron Uniform Database guy, he was he was wearing those creamsicle uniforms with Bucko Bruce when he was drafted by Tampa Bay. It was only I think it was his second or third year they made the switch to the pewter uniforms, but Warren Sapp looked great in that creamsicle orange. And he was with the Buccaneers 7 consecutive Pro Bowls, 1997 through 2003, 4 consecutive All-Pro 1999 through 2002. 1999, he was the NFL's Defensive Player of the Year. He had another defensive tackle. He had 12 sacks. That tells you, what a force he was. Over his, he played 144 games for the Buccaneers, and he had 96 and a half sacks, which is just, I don't get defensive end, tackle, linebacker. I mean, that's just incredible production. He had 3 times he was in double-digit sacks, 97, 99, and 2000. And in 2000, he had 16 and a half sacks as a defensive tackle, which is just, it's a sack a game plus a half sack thrown in for good measure. And Of course, when you produce like that, the Buccaneers retired his number 99. And he was he also played for the Oakland Raiders from 2004 to 2007. He was still a good, stout guy in the middle, stopping the run. And was named to two all-decade teams. He was all-decade for the 1990s and the 2000s.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be that athletic and be the size he was, he was listed 6'2", 303 pounds. That's one large creamsicle, that's for sure.
He was a wide body. He took up a lot of space. And to move like that, it was I can only think of maybe two or three guys. Like, he was almost like had the similar body type to William the Refrigerator Perry, but he was a lot faster than Perry was.
Yeah, that, absolutely. And, you talk about with the Raiders, should have been on the decline at that point. 2006 is second to last season, 10 sacks that season.
That's right. Yeah, he was still productive. He didn't have the huge, crazy numbers that he had with Tampa Bay, but he was still a good, solid player, and he was a contributor to those teams until he retired.
Most definitely he was. So I think there's another candidate to go on our list here. I think Warren Sapp, number two on our list. Okay. We'll talk about Jason Taylor next.
Let's talk about Jason Taylor.
Okay.
Primarily, he had a very unusual career arc. He had three stints with the Dolphins. The first one, 1997 through 2007. He was played in six Pro Bowls for the Dolphins. Three times he was all pro, 2000, 2002, 2006. In 2006, he was the NFL Player of the Year. He had, in addition to 13 and a half sacks, he had 9 forced fumbles, which is, a crazy number for one season. Some guys don't even have that in a career. 2002, he had 18 and a half sacks. And over his career with Miami, 204 games played, 131 sacks. Very, very impressive production. In addition, he had a nose for the end zone. He has 9 career touchdowns, 3 on interceptions, 6 on fumbles, which is a record for touchdowns scored by a defensive player. And I know that because one of my former favorite Giants, George Martin, used to have that record, but Jason Taylor broke it. George Martin had 7. And Jason Taylor, all-decade team for the 2000s. So he also played 1 year for the Washington Redskins in 2008, went back to Miami for 2009, then made the move to the Jets in 2010, and then played one final year. He ended his career with Miami in 2011, and he was elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2017.
I think, Jason Taylor must have played like with some ruby slippers, because there was no place like home, and he kept ending up back in South Beach, like you said. So
yeah, that's right.
Wants to go to
weather's
Washington.
A lot better there than New York and Washington.
That's for sure. That's for sure. A lot better scenery too.
Yeah, I also need to add, in addition to his 9 touchdowns, he also scored 3 safeties in his career.
Yeah, that's a big number there too. Wow, that's a lot of points for a defensive lineman.
Nine touchdowns. For a defensive lineman, 9 touchdowns. I mean, that's more than Deion Sanders scored. You always think of him returning interceptions. He returned a lot of kickoffs and punts too. But 9 touchdowns, strictly playing defense, no special teams or anything like that.
Extremely productive in more ways than once, even the points on the scoreboard. So, yeah, Jason Taylor, I think another no-brainer to go on our list on our top 10.
Yep. And we also need to add, so he wore 99 for all those years but one. When he was in Washington, he did switch to number 55. But okay. all the years with Miami and the 1 year with the Jets, he was number 99.
And you know what? That was his worst sack year of his entire career. He only had 3.5 sacks.
Why'd you change the number? I mean, did the Redskins – I should have looked this up. Did the Redskins have a 99? If someone did, they should have given it to Taylor. I mean, come on.
So he must have had an injury or something, because he only played 8 games out of the 13. It was 2008 a strike year, possibly?
No, that was a full year.
Okay, so he only started 8 games, only played in 13. So Not a good year for Jason Taylor.
Class of 99. And actually, that's an excellent segue to our last Hall of Famer, Cortez Kennedy.
Okay, well, let's jump right in.
Yeah, so Kennedy, he's our guy with the asterisk. He played with Seattle 1990 through 2000. Great career, 8 Pro Bowls, 3 times All-Pro. He was the Defensive Player of the Year in 1992. And not coincidentally, that was the year he wore number 99. All of his career, he wore number 96. But for 1 year, 92, and again, defensive tackle, 1992, had 14 sacks. He was in the Pro Bowl. He was All-Pro. He was Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, that's odd that he would change his number in the middle of his career. You know, we're 96 for 2 seasons, same team.
Yeah, well, he did have a reason, and he was friends with another 99 that we're going to talk about, Jerome Brown with the Eagles. He died in a car accident in the 1992 offseason, so Cortez Kennedy wore number 99 to honor Jerome Brown.
Ah, okay. All right, very good reason.
But you would think, you know, having such a big year, Defensive Player of the Year, hey, number 99, that number works for me. I'm going to stick with it. But he went back to number 96. And he was still, I mean, obviously a very good player, bunch of Pro Bowls. He had a couple of more All-Pros. But he did that all wearing 96. He gave up the 99. It was one and done.
Yeah. But another very solid player, great player. And I think just his 1 year wearing a 99, I think that might make him one of the top 99. So I don't know if we want to put him on now or you want to wait to see who we have.
I would. You know why? Because that year, 92, when he had 14 sacks, the Seahawks had a very, very, very bad year. They were 2-14. And for him to have that kind of production and be named, you know, be recognized, you know, it's hard. You know, players have good years and Pro Bowl caliber years on bad teams. But typically, if, you know, you're 2-14, you're not going to get noticed and you're probably going to get snubbed. But he got all those accolades, all pro, Pro Bowl, Player of the Year on a 2-14. And you think 2-14, teams are pretty much running the ball on you in the second half. You're not going to have that many sack opportunities. I mean, imagine if Seattle were 8-8 and competitive, teams would have been passing more. He probably could have padded that sack total quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. If you're less opportunities and you're still getting the sack numbers, that's having a real, real good year.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm convinced. Let's put him on. He's our fourth guy. All of our Hall of Famers are in our
you
list.
You can't not put a Hall of Famer in the top 10 unless you have 11 Hall of Famers.
Right. Well, if he would have maybe had, you know, wore number 99 and only had like 2 sacks or something.
He did that number 99 proud. He never did that weird number 96, and a 6 is like an upside down 9, you know.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. All right. Well, now we're in our land of the folks not yet in the Hall of Fame. But like we said, I think that we're going to have a bunch of these guys might be in there, a handful of them anyway.
There's definitely 2, and we have one guy who was once a senior candidate who didn't quite make it, but, you know, who knows, maybe he'll get a second chance. But I'd like to start chronologically, because I was trying to dig deep and find out who was the earliest player to wear number 99 that I can find. And I know we talked about the last time I was on how it was very rare for players in the 20s, and they're pretty much until the All-America Conference in 46, in the 20s, 30s, and early 40s, players didn't typically wear numbers above the mid-30s. They were, you know, single digits, teens, 20s, low 30s. But I did find in 1920, in the playing for the Decatur Stallies, a gentleman by the name of Hub Shoemake. He was a guard. He played 6 games for the Stallies that year. And he's the only player in 1920 who wore the number 99.
Wow, you did go back in the record books there.
Right back to the start. Now, I went through the newspaper archives. I was looking in all the Illinois newspapers. I couldn't find any press clippings on Hub, but, you know, I did need to mention his name. 6 games, 1920, wore the number 99.
And that even sounds like a great football name of that era. You know,
it does.
Great nicknames.
It does. That's a good, that's a typical of the time, right? A blue collar, you know, he had an off-season job. He was probably a cobbler.
could be.
Pounding the leather.
Wow. Okay.
And actually, you know, not surprising, you know, Decatur, you know, George Halas, he played at the University of Illinois. We know George Halas liked his Illini.
Yeah, that's for sure. He had a pretty good one there for a while when he got out of Illinois. And he himself was from Illinois. So
Yes, he was.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you mentioned Hub. And who's our next one chronologically you'd like to talk about?
Our next one, still pretty early, started playing in 1938, is Perry Schwartz. So he's the first player of some renown, someone who was well-known and highly regarded that wore the number 99. So Perry played for the Brooklyn Dodgers from 1938 to 1942. He was an end. He played in four Pro Bowls, and he was two times first team All-Pro, 1941 and 1942. And as I was going through the newspaper archives, it was interesting. Newspapers had, you know, there was no official, you know, all pro, you know, the newspaper columnists, the guys who covered football, everyone would come up with their own list. He was very, very widely regarded in, you know, papers, not just the New York papers, the Illinois papers, Wisconsin, you know, anyone who covered football regularly. They all had him ranked as the second best end next to Don Hutson. So if you're an end playing in the 1940s and you're being mentioned in the same sentence as Don Hutson, that's a pretty good compliment. You know, that's like someone in the 80s or 90s, you're the second best receiver after Jerry Rice. So Perry Schwartz was very highly regarded. He was being compared to Don Hutson and the all-pro, everybody's all-pro team from like 39, 40, 41, 42. You know, the ends were Don Hutson and Perry Schwartz. No. And I did share with you this morning, I sent you the email as I'm going through the newspapers. I did find one anomaly. So he gets a very tiny asterisk. I did find that one photo of him playing a game in 1942 where he was wearing 69 rather than his usual 99. I don't know if it was a tailor mistake, you know, the six, the nine upside down, or if his jersey got torn up and they had to give him another one, because the next week, the newspaper had a picture of him wearing his number, his normal 99, but for at least one game that year, he did wear 69.
Yeah, that's the second one we've had a nine upside down, isn't it? So,
I know. Well, you know, they're pretty close. You know, it's not like a seven or a two.
You have a keen eye as you're scrolling through the old newspaper articles.
It's all those years of looking through the newspapers for the Gridiron Uniform Database. The little things, they jump out at me. They become big things.
But hey, that's what makes the fact-finding interesting. That's for sure.
It is. So, you know, like many, many players of that era, they had their careers interrupted for military service to fight in World War II, and Perry was one of those guys. So, you know, 1943, 44, 45, he was overseas. He came back in 1946 in the America Conference with the New York Yankees, and he played one last season with the Yankees in 1946. But that year he wore number 57 rather than his 99. But the All-America Conference, you know, had that different numbering system where numbers were handed out by position. So ends were 50 to 59. So he couldn't wear 99.
Okay. Wow. You really dug into the old books of the NFL and APFA and some of the rival leagues here.
I try to leave no stone unturned. I dig until I got to find at least one thing on each guy, even Hub Shoemake, right? I knew he was from the University of Illinois. I got to find something for somebody.
great work on there. Okay. What player would you like to talk about next?
Marshall Goldberg of the Chicago Cardinals. We kind of alluded to him a little bit earlier talking about the Hall of Famers. So he played for the Cardinals, interrupted again by the war, 1939 through 1943. He was in the military for several years, and then he came back just in time for the run of the Cardinals, their championships, 46 through 48. He was a multi-purpose back. He played halfback. He played fullback. And the Cardinals, so he has two numbers retired. He was a Pitt Panther. I know you're partial to the Panthers. He wore number 42, which the Pitt Panthers retired. The Cardinals also retired his 99, although this year, with his family's consent, the Cardinals did unretire number 99, so J.J. Watt could wear it this year. And Goldberg was he's not in the Hall of Fame, but he was a nominee as a senior candidate in 2008. But unfortunately, he didn't make the cut, so he's still on the outside looking in.
Well, I think he's going to get a lot more press this year. I mean, he already has with what he did with the publicity, the J.J. Watt asking the family and everything. So he's got a lot of great publicity. So maybe that'll help him next time the seniors are up for the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that'd give him some good mojo. He has a little good karma for being a selfless guy, sharing his number 99.
So, yeah, maybe J.J. will even put in some good words for him. And might go a long way. All right. So Marshall Goldberg, he's a favorite of one of our friends, Joe Ziemba, who's a Cardinals historian.
He was a contributing member to the Cardinals' last championship team.
Yeah. So very great player. So
1947.
I'm sure Joe will be very appreciative. We spoke about Marshall Goldberg as well. Okay. So who do we want to talk about next?
Jumping over to the AFL, we have Ernie Ladd. He played for the San Diego Chargers from 1961 through 1965. And he also played 66 through 68. He split time with Kansas City and the old Houston Oilers. So with the Chargers, Ladd, he was a four-time Pro Bowler and three times All-Pro, 1961, and 1964, 1965. But as a Charger, he wore number 77, not 99, but at least it was a symmetrical number. But in his years with Kansas City and Houston, he did wear number 99 with both teams.
Okay. Very impressive work once again.
Yep. And he was a defensive tackle. And, the thing that made him unique, for that era, he was an enormous man. He was 6'9", and he typically played in the 290 pounds. I think a couple of years he was actually 300 pounds, which is, for the 1960s is very unusual. That at that time, defensive tackles were probably 265. 275 was probably considered large. So he was playing 290 and above for most of his career.
Pretty good size for nowadays, being 6'9"
that's a good size. Good size, but at that time he was like a giant on the field, and he was he was very fast and athletic. He wasn't just a big guy, clogging up space. He was a very, very agile and productive player.
Wow, I'm glad you shared his story. I wasn't aware of him, so thank you for that. Okay, who is our next 99 that we would like to talk about?
The next one, jumping forward a decade, we have Mark Gastineau, who played for the New York Jets from 1979 through 1988. He was a five-time Pro Bowler, and he was All-Pro three consecutive years, 1982, 1983, 1984. He led the NFL in sacks two of those years. In 1983, he had 19. In 1984, he had 22, which was officially, the sacks became official in 1982. The 22 sacks in 84 was the record until Michael Strahan passed it in 2001. But unofficially, the year that the Jets' famous sack exchange with Joe Klecko and Marty Lyons and Abdul Salam, when they became a popular thing in New York in 1981, Gastineau unofficially was credited with 20 sacks. You won't find that in the record books, but it probably happened because I watched a lot of Jet games back then. So 20 sacks is probably accurate.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's the first one that did it, but he's the first one that I can remember of having the sort of the sack celebration dance.
That's right. He got, I'm not sure if he had the first, but he definitely got the notoriety for it. And he's actually the reason that that rule, the celebrations were banned for a while. I think it was 1983. I remember the Jets were still playing in Shea Stadium. It was against the Rams. There was a bench clearing brawl because he had a sack. He was doing a dance, and it might have been Jackie Slater. One of the Rams offensive linemen didn't like it and pushed him, and then it was just mayhem. And the players were coming off the benches. So then there was that no celebrating rule for a long time after that.
Yeah, that's when the famous quote was the NFL was the no fun league.
No fun league. That's right. That's right. The Redskins, the fun bunch. That was the end of that. You can thank Mark Astineau.
Yeah. Gasso and a bunch of wide receivers that like to do the spike dances. You know, probably Billy White Shoes Johnson. Yeah. And who's the one for Washington that like to
Dexter Manley.
Manley, right.
Dexter Manley, yep.
So,
you know, 1984, Gastineau had the 22 sacks. His production, you know, at least sack-wise, dropped off quite a bit because that was the last year that the Jets were a 4-3 team. In 1985, Bud Carson became their defensive coordinator, and he switched the Jets to a 3-4 defense. So the responsibilities of a 3-4 defensive end are a lot different than a 4-3. You know, in the 4-3, you know, you're coming off the edge, you have more opportunities to rush the passer. You're usually getting, you know, single block. But the, you know, the technique for a 3-4 end is take on two blockers and occupy them so the linebackers can make plays. So he didn't have as many, he was still a good player, but, you know, the numbers, at least the sack numbers, don't quite reflect it because they're playing a much different scheme. There's a lot of differences for the ends in a 3-4 than a 4-3.
Now, nowadays, you know, in the modern era, I think maybe they would have took him and had him stand up and be called an outside linebacker.
Possibly.
A 3-4.
Yeah.
Use his speed and pass rushing ability. But some guys can't make the transition from a hand on the ground rush to
stand
on 2 feet. So
it is different. Not everybody can do it.
Yeah. So a tremendous player. I mean, those are just some fantastic numbers to have, you know, 20 at least twice, almost a third time.
Unofficially three.
Yeah. So, wow, that is just some great numbers and a great player, Mark Gastineau. So, we can talk about him. 6'5", 266 pounds. That famous gangrene New York sack exchange. Great, great nickname for him, too. Okay. What 99 would you like to speak of next?
We already mentioned him, and it's a nice segue because it's another player that wore green as a Jerome Brown for the Philadelphia Eagles. I mentioned this already. Unfortunately, he had a short career. He played for the Eagles from 1987 through 1991, and unfortunately lost his life in the summer of 1992 in an auto accident. But he was a defensive tackle and a very, very, very good one. He was a two-time Pro Bowler, 1990, 1991, and he was All-Pro both of those years. And again, a tackle, you know, 1989, 10 and a half sacks, which is very good production, you know, being on the inside. And it probably helps a little bit play next to Reggie White. He's taken up some double teams for you. But, you know, you're also racing Reggie White to the quarterback. Everyone knows Reggie White has a nose for the quarterback. And if you're getting there before Reggie, you know, you're accomplishing something. In that year, 1989, he also had five fumbles recovered, and the Eagles retired his number 99.
Yeah, rightfully so, because like you said, he was probably, you know, can you imagine if him and Reggie White would have continued on that same path, you know, same team? And didn't Buddy Ryan, wasn't he the head coach of the Eagles at that time too?
He was the coach through 1990, and 91 it was Rich Kotite.
Okay, so he did. Buddy Ryan did have both of them on his defensive line for at least
he did. Yeah, years. Yep, 88, 89, 90. That was Buddy Ryan.
Yeah, wow. One that many offensive linemen and coordinators probably had nightmares when they had to play the Eagles.
I know he gave Phil Sims nightmares. I think, that year with 10 sacks, I'll bet 5 or 6 of them were on Phil Sims. Those guys were tough on the Giants.
Yeah. Wow. They're probably getting the Giants back for the decade earlier with the vicious pass rush that they had then. So it made Jaworski's life miserable. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so where do we want to go to next?
Well, we can go from Eastern to Western Pennsylvania. We can talk about LaVon Kirkland. He was a Steeler for most of his career, 1992 through 2000. And then at the end of his career, he split time with Seattle, and he ended his career with the Eagles in 2002. But he was LaVon Kirkland, while he was a Steeler, he was a two-time Pro Bowler. 1996, 1997. He was all pro in 1997. And he was, depending on the scheme, he was either an inside linebacker in a 4-3 or he was a middle linebacker in a 3-4. And, the thing that made him a little different than a lot of linebackers, he was a very, very big man for a linebacker. He played 280, 290 pounds, which is, a defensive lineman weight, but he's playing, two-point stance behind the line, but he was quick and he had a lot of range for a big man. And probably his most notable game was Super Bowl 30 against the Cowboys, in a losing effort, but the Steelers defense played a great game. He had 10 tackles and he had a quarterback sack of Troy Aikman in that game.
Yeah, one play I remember from that Super Bowl, I like to forget most of it, at least the two interceptions O'Donnell threw, but it was Emmitt Smith. The Cowboys were down inside the 5. Emmitt Smith was going to do one of his famous, go up over the top and stick the ball over the goal line. And Kirkland sort of mirrored him and just came up and just hit a vicious hit, probably about the 1 yard line in midair. And it was
the defense crunching. Played really well. Emmitt Smith and the running game was their bread and butter behind that offensive line. But, going through my research and finding notes, I didn't write this down, but I'm pretty sure the Steelers held Dallas to, or it was Smith to something like 57 yards rushing in that Super Bowl, which is way, he was probably averaging close to 100 yards a game at that time in his career.
Yeah. That's when he got
a lot of, at least in the high 80s or 90s.
That's when he got a lot of those yards for his record setting rushing yards for the NFL record. That's for sure.
He did.
Now, LaVon Kirkland, it's weird how things happen, but in the last week and a half, LaVon Kirkland's one of my favorite linebackers. I loved his size. I loved his range. I loved how he hit. He's right there, right behind Jack Lambert's probably the only one above him in my hierarchy of favorite linebackers. I love linebackers. I have a jersey of LaVon Kirkland. I have the white road jersey. And I have my 17-year-old daughter last week called me up and texted me at work, and she said, "Hey, we have our spirit day today. We're allowed to wear jerseys of NFL jerseys." So I'm going through your closet. I'm like, "Okay, go ahead." So she goes through, and I come home, and she just got home from school about the same time, and she's wearing a 99 LaVon Kirkland. And she said, "Oh my gosh, teachers were coming up to me and saying, 'Oh, LaVon Kirkland, I haven't heard that name in ages.'" So I said, "Wow, that's kind of cool." But same day, one of my associates, a fellow podcaster on Sports History Network, Aaron Harris, does the Football Odyssey podcast. He's another Steelers fan. He sent me an email. He goes, "Hey, you're really going to like my podcast I'm releasing tomorrow." He goes, "I'm going to leave it as a surprise, the guest I have for you." I'm like, "Okay, can't wait to hear it." So I get on her. He has LaVon Kirkland on. And what a great conversation they have. So, nice. So if I... LaVon Kirkland lovers out there, just go to Sports History Network, look on the Football Odyssey podcast, and that's a recent interview with LaVon Kirkland, who's now coaching one of the teams down south. I forget who he's coaching, but he's an assistant coach. But great stories he has on that podcast. So I have good memories of him, that's for sure. Okay, so yeah. Where do we want to go next on our list of these great number 99s?
We're going to stay right where we are in Pittsburgh, and we're going to go to Brett Kiesel, who also almost wore number 99 consecutively. So LaVon Kirkland last year with the Steelers was 2000. Brett Kiesel's first year, 2002. So you had the 1 year gap without a 99 on the Steelers. And Kiesel wore that number 99 up through the 2014 season, including his one Pro Bowl season in 2010.
Yeah, he was another formidable, I mean, he was a lineman, just a great player. And, you know, a couple of great nicknames, of course, having named Kiesel, people called him Diesel. And then he got a different nickname later on in his career when he grew some great the facial beard. Here.
The beard. That's the most intimidating part of his game was that beard.
and he did some great things with that beard, especially at the end of his career. He would get the first day that they would report to training camp. He would have go to a barber shop or something right before he showed up for practice. And they'd take his beard off and they'd donate the beard hairs to some charity of some kind. And, he'd give a bunch of money and the players would chip in a bunch of money, but gave good publicity to the charity as well. So, always like that when somebody can take, one of their features that is recognized and use it for good things too. So a good
yeah.
Guy.
And that's not, the players with the big beards now, it's not that uncommon. I think every team probably has one or two of them, but he was one of the first guys in the league to have that really, bushy lumberjack look with the whiskers coming out of the chin strap and the face mask. That was very uncommon. And plus his beard was red. So it really stood out.
Yeah. I think probably the one now people think about is probably Fitzpatrick, the quarterback.
Right. Right, but, sure but he was doing it before Fitz.
Yeah, that's
Kiesel
true.
Did it
that's
before
true.
Fitz. You got to give credit where credit's due.
That's true. Yeah, but great player. He was one I was sad to see go when he finally had to hang it up. But we really enjoyed him down and watched him as a Steeler. So another a great memory lane of the Pittsburgh crew. Okay, so what player and team do we want to talk about next with these 99s?
We have Chris Canty, who split his career pretty evenly between three teams. He was a Dallas Cowboy from 2005 to 2008. He was with the Giants from 2009 to 2012. And then he was with the Baltimore Ravens 2013 through 2015. He never played in a Pro Bowl. He was never all pro, but he was a very talented and productive player in his time. And he was, versatile as well. He played different positions in different schemes. In Dallas and Baltimore, he was an end in 3-4s, but with the Giants, he was a defensive tackle in a 4-3. And he was a little bit, I think, unusual for that 4-3 tackle in that he was he was very tall. He was 6'7", and he was heavy. He was about 305 pounds, but he had a very a very lean frame. He wasn't a wide body. He didn't have a lot of girth, but with that tall, 6'7" frame, I think probably, was what you would more prototypical for an end than a tackle, but he still had, good years for the Giants, and he helped them on their Super Bowl run in 2011.
Yeah, and that's always amazes me when you have some of these big guys that are playing at defensive line, because it's a game of leverage and the lower the lower center of gravity you get, you'd never think that. But you have Ed Tuttle Jones, Canty, and there's a litany of great big tall players that played in defensive line that had great careers. And I guess knocking down passes is a good thing too, being tall.
Yeah, he had very long arms to go with that tall frame. But, like you're saying about the leverage, in a 4-3 on any given snap, one of the two tackles is getting a double team. He's getting the guard and the center.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
For that tall, that 6'7" frame, that's the guard or the center gets a shoulder underneath you. You're going backwards.
Yeah, that's
but,
for
but
sure.
He played strong at the point of attack, and he played very well. He was a good player.
Yeah, I remember who. Most of his career, watching him bounce around that AFC East for so long. And then, of course, with Baltimore, I'd see him twice a year. So
that's right.
Yeah. Very good player. Definitely one worth mentioning here in our list of great number 99s. But we still got a whole bunch of really good players that wear number 99.
We do. We have two current players, and they're very good. And we're going to have a lot to say about each of them. So the first one would be J.J. Watt. He was a member of the Houston Texans from 2011 up until last year, 2020. This year, he's playing for the Cardinals, and he's wearing the number 99. Jester from the Goldberg family. J.J. Watt is primarily a defensive end. And like we talked about with one or two guys, sometimes he plays in the two-point stance on the edge as an outside linebacker, but he's primarily an end. He's played in five Pro Bowls and was five times All-Pro. 2012, he led the NFL with 20 and a half sacks. And in 2015, he led the NFL again that year with 17 and a half sacks. And he also had 20 and a half sacks in 2014. And remarkably, 20 and a half sacks, he didn't lead the NFL. Justin Houston of Kansas City had 22 that year. You would think 20 and a half sacks, he led the NFL three times. Well, not that he was really good that year, but he was bested by a sack and a half. And so he almost missed two complete seasons. In 2016 and 2017, back-to-back years, he only combined to play in eight games. He had two games, and then he had back surgery. The next year he came back from back surgery, he had a knee injury. So he missed almost, virtually two complete seasons. But he still came back and was a very, very good player for the Texans. And he's one of only three players to be a three-time defensive player of the year. That was 2012, 2014, and 2015.
Yeah, I just watched the game this past weekend with the Cardinals playing the Browns, and he was still at almost 33 years old, an unstoppable force. I know they showed him the one time where he made a tackle for loss, and they showed him walking over the sideline, taking his helmet off, mouthing the words, "You can't block me. You can't block me."
He can still bring it. They rotate him a bit to keep him fresh. He's not an every down player anymore, but he's still, when he's revved up, that motor's running, he's just about unblockable.
And the dude's got arms like tree trunks coming out of his shirt too.
He does. And he has that big brace in the one arm too. He uses it like a club.
Yeah. Very powerful, great technique. Excellent player. So glad we could talk about him today. So he's definitely one under strong consideration.
Yep. I'm still not used to seeing him in that Cardinal uniform now.
But they're really stockpiling some good players out there.
Oh, they're 6-0.
Yeah. And they just got Zach Ertz this past week too. So
yeah,
getting better.
The strong get stronger.
that's for sure. That's for sure. Okay. I know we have a couple more we probably want to talk about.
Yep. Yeah, speaking of unblockable, Aaron Donald, who just did a number on my Giants a couple of days ago.
He does a number on everybody, though.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So he shows no partiality.
Are still a little fresh for me. Speaking of Phil Sims taking like five or six sacks, Daniel Jones, I think, is still seeing number 99 in his nightmares. So Aaron Donald, he's been with the Rams since 2014. He's another hybrid guy. Sometimes he plays end. Sometimes he plays tackle. Seven Pro Bowls and counting. I'm sure it's going to be eight in a couple of months. Six times All-Pro. He's been All-Pro every year since 2015. I'm pretty sure that's going to be seven by the end of this year. He led the NFL in sacks in 2018. He had 20 and a half. This young man has already been named to the 2010s All-Decade team, and he's the second of three players to be the Defensive Player of the Year, which he's won in 2017, 2018, and last year in 2020. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him win a fourth one, if not this year, sometime very soon. And he'll be the leader in that category. He'll separate that three-way tie.
Well, I'm a little bitter about him getting it last year. I mean, he had a great season, but I think JJ's brother, TJ Watt, I think he actually beat him in every category, the top three categories they look at. He had more sacks. He had more tackles for loss and quarterback hits than Aaron Donald. So I was a little surprised that Aaron Donald got over TJ Watt, but hey, I'm biased. He wears black and gold.
No, it's a good argument. It's a good argument. It has a lot of merit.
I'm not disagreeing with you. And I can't complain about Aaron Donald, though, because he was a great Pitt Panther, too. So
That's right. Your second Pitt Panther.
Yeah. So have some good 99s going in there. That's for sure.
That's right.
From the city of Pittsburgh.
So with all these guys who've won the Defensive Player of the Year three times, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the first one to do it. Did not wear number 91, but Lawrence Taylor, he won the Defensive Player of the Year 1981, 1982, and 1986.
Okay.
And since tied by J.J. Watt and Aaron Donald. And again, I'm pretty sure Aaron Donald is going to have a fourth one sometime soon.
Hopefully not this year, because I think TJ and some other, there's a couple other players are really off to some hot starts too. Miles Garrett, some great players we have in the NFL on the defensive side of the ball. So a lot of competition, but Aaron Donald is definitely at the top of those lists. That's for sure. Okay. Do you have anybody else that you want to mention?
That's it. Those are my two current players. And, you know, we'd like to talk about who's going to be in the Hall of Fame. I think J.J. Watt and Aaron Donald are as no-brainer as it gets. They should both be first ballot slam dunks, busting Canton.
Okay, I totally agree there. And I'm going to probably, with your permission, I'm going to put them as our fifth and sixth players on our top 10 list.
You absolutely have my permission. Put them up there.
Okay.
Undisputed.
I think Mark Gastineau's got a shot at getting in
Definitely.
The Football Hall of Fame. So, and I think
definitely
on our top 10 list, as we'll put him in. He's our seventh player in.
Especially when you consider, you know, I mean, the switch from the 3-4 to from the 4-3 to the 3-4, it really affected his statistics a lot. His, you know, his sack numbers, he had 22 in 1984. And I'm just going to take a look real quick. What did he do in 1985? I know I have. Yeah. 1985, Gastineau had. We had 13 and a half. That's pretty good for a 3-4 end. But then the next year he had two. Then he had 4.5. And his last year he only had 7. So, you know, he his last 2 years in the 4-3, 19 sacks, 22. Then he dropped to 13.5. And then he was single digits the rest of the way. You know, if he played 4-3 end those other years, I'll bet that sack number would have been a lot higher.
Well, he also had Father Time grabbing his ankle and slowing him down a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah, so. I see he had a couple of games missed, too. He only played 7 games in 1988. But, you know, he was still, you know, regardless what position, what scheme, he was still a good player.
Yeah, very productive when he was on during his prime. So I think that makes him one of the best 99s ever in NFL history. Okay, so we have three more that we need to get on this top 10 list. And there's some players that we talked about that I think are probably some good candidates that we can, we talk about Marshall Goldberg, LaVon Kirkland, Perry Schwartz, Ernie Ladd.
Perry Schwartz was going to be my surprise pick. I really want to put him up there as one of my top 10 number 99s. You know, Perry Schwartz, he played for the Brooklyn Dodgers. He was on so many all-pro teams, you know, alongside Don Hutson. You know, Don Hutson was the Jerry Rice of the 1930s and 40s. So if you're being, you know, second to Don Hutson, I mean, you're probably the best in any other era.
And
he was a two-way, you know, he was a two-way player. You know, he led the NFL in yards per catch a couple of times. But, you know, looking through those newspaper pictures I sent you a couple today, there was one of him playing defense where he was forcing a fumble. You know, those he's leading the NFL in yards per catch, but he's also playing defense.
Yeah, two-way play. Yeah, I totally agree with you, especially when you gave the four Pro Bowls, and I think he had a couple All-Pros too. Yeah, I think he should be on that list. So, yeah. So
that's he's right. Our eighth. He wasn't affected by scheme, right? Everybody was playing the single wing then. But, you know, he had his career, like so many people, you know, of that era, interrupted by World War II. He had a big chunk of his career taken out, and he lost, you know, I think 4 years. And then he came back and played 1 year in the All-America Conference. But, you know, definitely Perry Schwartz. He's one of my 10.
Okay. I agree with you there. And I think, you know, Jerome Brown's another one from his, you know, he only had that short career, 5 seasons with the 99. But, man, that's some productivity there, too.
Quality over quantity. He was he was a force. And, you know, I watched the Eagles, you know, play the Giants twice a year. And, you know, they were on TV playing the, you know, in the NFC East almost every week with Madden and Summerall, and he and Reggie White, they were a heck of a tandem.
Yeah, I totally agree there. Now the 10th one, 10th position, you know, Chris Canty is another one that we mentioned. I don't want to fail to mention him. and Kiesel. But I think I would lean towards our 10th one as being a guy that's got his number retired with the oldest franchise in the National Football League.
That's who I had, Marshall Goldberg.
Okay, all yes. right. Well, we're seeing eye to eye. Yeah, I know it's no fun when you don't have controversy, but the agreements are fun too.
I'm a peace-loving man. I don't want to argue. I don't want to raise my voice. So, we're sharing a brain, though. That's good. That's good.
Yeah, I that's probably scary for you sharing a brain with me. But
well, we think alike.
You might have to get examined.
Why you keep inviting me back? That's why, you know, I did number one. You had me back for 99.
Yeah, you might want to call a doctor about this tomorrow, Larry. This might be frightening. Okay, so hey, that is a pretty good top 10. Let me just go through again who we have on here. We have the four Hall of Famers, Warren Sapp, Jason Taylor, Dan Hampton, Cortez Kennedy, J.J. Watt, Aaron Donald, we think are going to be in the Hall of Fame very soon, 5 years after their career's over. Mark Gastineau, we think someday will be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Marshall Goldberg with the 99 retired with the Cardinals. Perry Schwartz, the top end in the NFL at his era next to Don Hutson, and Jerome Brown, a very productive defensive player that lost his life a little too early and didn't get to finish his NFL career. Wonder what he would have done, continuing that. So great top 10. What a way to finish off this series that we've had. It's been so much fun with some excellent players and an excellent guest who's done a lot of hard work, Larry, and I really appreciate you helping out here today.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. I really enjoy you having me on, so thank you.
Well, what projects do you have going on in your football life, either on the Gridiron Uniform Database or on Big
Blue? There's always something going on there. You know, we're keeping up with the current season. We also had a couple of surprise historical finds of late. We found a good one for the New York Yankees of the AFL of 1941, very surprising uniform find with them, where we were changing colors and finding stripes, and that's up on the website now. And I also want to mention, because this comes up, a lot of people ask me on the database, the decade of the 1920s, 1920 through 1929, when we were re-platforming the site, those got lost from the main page, and those old teams like the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets and the Canton Bulldogs, you couldn't access them from the main page. You could only do it by going to the defunct franchises and then going through there. But they were just restored this past weekend. So you can view every team, every uniform very easily to navigate from 1920 all the way up to last year. So the 1920s are back there on the front page, and it's all just a click away.
Yeah. And if you're listening to this, we have each and every one of our podcasts. We thank Gridiron Uniform Database. It's in our show notes. There's a link to them on every single episode of Pixie and Dispatch. So make sure you check their great website out. They share so much with us, with Larry and Bill and Tim. We appreciate all that they do to help us do our jobs here too. So, fantastic website. So make sure you check it out. And how about on the Giants side of things, how are things going?
Currently not too good, but I'm working on an article from when the Giants were good from 1990. So that's, it's fun to look back and remember when, the Giants really were Giants.
Well, I wasn't talking about how the team was performing. I was talking more about that.
Well, I told you, have me thinking about Aaron Donald, and boy, he really tore the Giants a new one this past week. So I'm still not over it. It's only Tuesday. I start looking forward to the next Sunday on Wednesday. So tomorrow morning, I'll feel a lot better, and I'll be thinking about the Carolina Panthers and looking forward, not back.
Carolina's taken a couple on the chin too this year, so maybe the Giants will have some luck against
them. Yeah, maybe we can win one. We'll see.
And I don't think McCaffrey's playing in this game yet either, so takes away part of their offense there, a big part
we'll
of
see.
Their offense.
The defense isn't doing too good, so we'll see. They could make his backup look like an all-pro. You never know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, Larry, I appreciate you once again. Thank you so much for helping on all the episodes that you did, and especially for this one. And we really appreciate your research and your due diligence on digging up these great stories and honoring these excellent players in football history. So thank you.
Oh, thank you again. Thanks for having me. And, you know, I probably say this every time you have me on, but, you know, I really, really, really love, you know, the early, you know, 1920 through, you know, the 1940s. I think it's just such an interesting era of football with the strategy. There's just so many great players and coaches and who were innovators. And yeah, it's sad, but they kind of get overlooked and forgotten about. And whenever you, like, you know, you watch the NFL Network, top 10 this, top 100 that, you know, it's, they pretty much cover the Super Bowl era and everything prior to that. There's just so many, so many great players, and it's just so interesting. And that's, you know, it's what I love to do. And, you know, I appreciate you giving me an outlet to share something that I love. So thank you.
All right, Larry. Well, we hope to have you on real soon in a different capacity, one of our other series we'll talk about, because I love talking about those 1920s, 1930s teams too. That's one of my favorite eras for sure. So, hey, until the next time, Larry, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, are you ready for some football? Some fantasy football? How about some daily fantasy football? Silly questions, right? Of course you are. You're ready to talk some smack and win some cash every Sunday and Thursday and Monday and whenever there's football games. The Sports History Network invites you to play your daily fantasy football this season at ThriveFantasy.com. Thrive Fantasy offers hundreds of thousands, millions in cash every day on NBA, MLB, PGA, golf, cricket, esports, and of course, NFL football. Every week during the 2021 NFL season, Thrive Fantasy has pool play contests and heads-up matches with prizes of all sizes, and even free play contests for real money. Sign up with Thrive Fantasy today to get a 100% match bonus on your first deposit for up to $100 in free daily fantasy football play. Visit sportshistorynetwork.com/thrive. That's THRIVE. Or enter promo code SHN when depositing at the cashier. Join Thrive Fantasy today, earn cash prizes, and support great shows like this at the Sports History Network. Now that's a win-win-win situation for you to kick off your own NFL season.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.